In Uganda, a bill to criminalize homosexuality is moving ahead in the legislature. If passed, it would punish some gay behavior with death. The bill has been a major headache for American churches with ties to the bill's supporters. Rick Warren and other evangelical leaders have condemned it. But as NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports, one U.S. megachurch is standing by its Ugandan partner.
You can't mistake what Ugandan pastor Martin Sempa thinks about homosexuality.
This is sick, and it's therefore deviant. We do not want it.
Sempa, who pastors an evangelical Christian church, has become the face of Uganda's anti-homosexuality movement. He organizes anti-gay rallies, preaches that many homosexuals are pedophiles, and shows hardcore gay pornography that critics say whips up sentiment against gay men and lesbians. Michael Jones is a gay rights activist in the United States.
Martin Sempa makes no bones about going around to churches, to community centers, to different neighborhoods, and saying things like gays and lesbians should be put in prison, they should be killed.
And if the anti-homosexuality bill is passed, that's what will happen. The bill imposes a death penalty for gay sex with a minor or having sex with your gay partner if you're HIV positive. Two consenting adults can get life in prison, and a straight person who knows someone who is gay and doesn't report it could get prison time as well. So why does Canyon Ridge Christian Church in Las Vegas, a megachurch with some 6,000 congregants, financially support Martin Sempa?
His heart is not to kill people. He is a pastor of the gospel that believes in redemption, and his heart is to redeem people.
Senior pastor Kevin Oder says Canyon Ridge began supporting Sempa's huge campus ministry, which preaches abstinence to college students, in 2007. So, does this mean Oder endorses the death penalty or life sentences for gay men and lesbians?
Personally, no.
So, why do you support someone who does?
We want to help the AIDS problem in Africa. And we found somebody who's making a difference, and so we support him.
Oder says in March, after Canyon Ridge leaders talked to Sempa, the Ugandan minister reversed himself and now says he favors removing the death penalty from the bill, though he still wants to criminalize homosexuality. That satisfied Pastor Oder, and he sees no reason to condemn Sempa or the bill.
Why do we, as a church in America, need to say something about a bill in Uganda?
They're engaging in Ugandan politics, whether they like it or not.
Again, gay rights activist Michael Jones.
Calling Martin Sempa, who is one of the foremost religious and political figures in Uganda, a strategic partner, is automatically engaging in Ugandan politics. There's just no way around that.
Pastor Oder says his church has, quote, a heart for gays. Canyon Ridge participates every year in a march for people with AIDS, and for the past 2 years, the church has opened its campus for HIV testing day.
We love everybody, including people with AIDS. There's two things, how you got AIDS and that you have AIDS. That you have AIDS is a matter of compassion.
Warren Throckmorton, a professor at the evangelical Grove City College, says Oder is trying to have it both ways, seeking to look compassionate in the United States.
And yet they're supporting a set of values and principles elsewhere that are very harsh and deadly, frankly, to the very community you say you want to reach. If you preach compassion here, you have to support compassion elsewhere.
On Friday, the Southern Nevada Health District severed its ties with the church, saying it was profoundly concerned about the relationship with Sempa. For his part, Oder says the church is only trying to help people with AIDS, and because of that, he says, we are being crucified. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A proposed Islamic cultural center and mosque two blocks from Ground Zero has become a flashpoint of controversy. The plans for Cordoba House are supported by most politicians in Manhattan and by religious leaders of many faiths. But in recent weeks, there's been growing tension over the project and some painfully raw emotions. NPR's Margot Adler has our story.
The plan for Cordoba House, which those who oppose it call a mosque and those who support it call a cultural center with a place for prayer, has been the dream of Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf and his wife Daisy Khan since 2004. Khan describes it as having facilities for
athletics, arts, culture, performances, lecture series, weddings, and also a much-needed prayer space.
The imam considers himself an Orthodox Muslim, but he's also a Sufi, a contemplative and mystical path in Islam. He and his wife run the American Society for Muslim Advancement, which is housed in a building used by many faiths that is part of Riverside Church. And Khan certainly sounds very much in that interfaith tradition.
Our religion has been hijacked by the extremists, and this center is going to create that counter-momentum, which will amplify the voices of the moderate Muslims. If we have to defeat the extremists, Muslims have to be leading that effort.
But at a Landmarks Commission meeting on Tuesday, the atmosphere was very different. Most of the speakers wanted the building to be landmark because of 9/11. Landmark status would mean the building could not be torn down, creating roadblocks for the new Islamic Cultural Center. Here are Barbara Pellucci, Sam Nunberg, and Andrea Quinn.
The landing gear from one of the planes from 9/11 attack crashed into that building. And that should be a museum.
It would be like removing the sunken ship from Pearl Harbor to erect a memorial for the Japanese kamikazes killed in the attack.
To deprive this building of landmark status is to allow for a citadel of Islamic supremacy to be erected in its place.
Ziad Ramadan spoke in support of the center, saying he was a Muslim whose wife and brother were first responders after the September 11th attacks. He said it was un-American to say where a house of worship should be.
A lot of the rhetoric that you're hearing, it's the same thing that's happening in Staten Island. It's the same thing that's happening in Brooklyn. It's called Islamophobia, pure and simple. And do not allow...
Please, let him speak.
Mayor Bloomberg supports the center. The community board for Lower Manhattan voted to support the project 29-1. In the race for governor, it's become a bone of contention with Republican candidate Rick Lazio calling on Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, his Democratic opponent, to investigate the project's funding.
This is a time when we need to ask serious questions that will keep the people of New York, and particularly the people of downtown Manhattan, feeling and actually being safe.
His Democratic opponent, Andrew Cuomo, says yes, some people are upset that the project is near ground zero.
The flip side, and what Mayor Bloomberg has said, we understand that. We also believe in the concept of freedom of religion and independence of religion, where government doesn't say what religions can be where.
Imam Faisal Abdul-Rauf and Daisy Khan have not been totally forthcoming about their funding, but Khan told NPR on Tuesday that they are just in the process of forming a new nonprofit, that fundraising won't really start until after the Landmarks Commission rules. A recent poll on the question of the mosque showed that 52% of New York City residents opposed the center. In more liberal Manhattan, 46% of the residents approved it, and 36% were opposed. Maurice Carroll of the Quinnipiac poll says the most notable statistic is that while 55% of New Yorkers say Islam is a peaceful religion,
22% say that it encourages violence. They wouldn't say that about Jews or Catholics or Protestants, and the explanation of that has to be the terrorists have poisoned people's minds.
But the memory of the 9/11 terrorist attacks are being fueled by all kinds of bloggers and activists, many of whom don't live downtown. There's even a new TV ad put out by the National Republican Trust PAC.
On September 11th, they declared war against us. And to celebrate that murder of 3,000 Americans, they want to build a monstrous 13-story mosque at Ground Zero. This ground is sacred.
The proposed building is two blocks from where the tower stood. Meanwhile, Daisy Khan finds herself somewhat shocked at everything that's going on. When I said, people say you are bringing Muslim extremist law to the U.S., she says Muslims pray, they fast, they give charity. Most American Muslims don't want to do anything that violates American law.
America works because of its religious freedoms and because it does not allow any one religion to dominate another. And we are very happy as Muslims with that arrangement.
But clearly, some others are not. The controversy doesn't show signs of letting up, but except for the landmarks question, the project has been approved. And even if Cordoba House has to stay within the existing building, it's hard to believe the project can be stopped. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
It turns out that the story of a Muslim community hoping to build a mosque and running into opposition is hardly limited to ground zero. All across the country, there are congregations that turned old storefronts into mosques. The congregations have grown. They want to build new houses of worship. And the zoning process often attracts local opposition. Ambassador Akbar Ahmed is a professor of Islamic Studies at American University and author of Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. Welcome.
Thank you, Robert.
And have I described a fairly common experience for American Muslims?
You have, Robert. I have traveled with my research assistants for about a year in America until last year. We visited 100 mosques. And what we found was that the attacks, and I'm not saying that they're attacks in terms of a physical attack. They may be just some pressure. There may be some phone calls. There may be some swastika kind of graffiti painted on mosques. These are A, widespread, and B, increasing in frequency.
Is somebody keeping count of incidents? Do you have any numbers that you know of?
I don't think so. Muslims do circulate items, but I don't think there's any study so far as to how many mosques are under attack. We do know that there may be something like 2,000 mosques in America. Some are big structures. Some are just one or two rooms. And because we were able to go to all the different kinds of mosques, we had an idea of what's going on in the mosques in America today.
It's commonly observed about Muslims in America that, unlike European countries, integration has been quite successful. There isn't an anger or an antagonism. Your research finds that may be an overly pretty picture of what's happening in this country.
It was not before 9/11. After 9/11, there are a lot of question marks about the community. Neighbors would really like to know more about the community. They do associate them with something alien, something perhaps related to terrorism. And the Muslim community and leadership really need to do a much better job of bridging this gap of misunderstanding that we found in the field.
And one event that makes a community inevitably that much more visible is trying to purchase a piece of land and to build there.
Exactly, because a mosque becomes a very physical symbol of a different religion. And of course, the great thing about America is that it is a country based in religious pluralism. And we found many, many Muslims on this journey still saying that America is the best place to be a Muslim. Many Muslims told us our role model is Thomas Jefferson. So there is the awareness among Muslims that things may be bad, but they would still be worse back home, wherever they come from.
At the beginning of your book, you describe an uncomfortable visit to a mosque, a congregation in Omaha, Nebraska. And I want to ask you about a question that is put to you when you arrive with your research assistants. Who are you? Are you from the FBI? I would assume at this stage that nearly every Muslim community has been contacted extensively by law enforcement.
It is, Robert, and we must not underestimate the sense of being under siege that Muslims are feeling. And therefore, when we turned up at these mosques asking questions, very often Muslims would ask, are you sure you guys aren't working for the FBI? Are you sure these papers will not land up with the FBI? And they assume that somehow that would get them in trouble.
Were there any particular conflicts, say, over mosque construction that really struck you as epitomizing that sort of conflict?
They did. For example, in Columbia, the mosque had been attacked and burned.
This is in Columbia, Tennessee.
And the mosque had been burned down. There was graffiti, swastikas, etc. And there were, of course, very heartbreaking stories, Muslims telling us that, look, we were born here. This is our country. And now people are saying, leave this place. Where do we go to? And at the same time, what was very encouraging is the Reverend Williamson, who is the local pastor of the Presbyterian Church, gives the community, the Muslim community, the keys to the church and says, this from now on can be used as your house of worship. So in this crisis, we also see great acts of charity and courage and humanity.
Apart from desecrating buildings, when there's actually a reasonably civil discussion about, you know, should the mosque be allowed to buy that piece of land and put up a building there, what sorts of things have Muslims encountered?
We found that Muslims face a lot of resistance. For example, in Iowa, in Cedar Rapids, the mosque that has been attacked recently, a week ago, we were told by the community that people would drive around. Sometimes they'd threaten, sometimes they'd yell. And the Muslims weren't complaining. They were trying to sort of say this with a sort of soft voice. But the complaint that the neighbors would have is encroachment in terms of parking or noise or strange-looking people wandering around and creating a sense of fear and uncertainty.
This is what the non-Muslim neighbors of the mosque would say about the community.
Because, Robert, we must recognize that a lot of Americans also have fears of the community. There is a gap between the understanding between mainstream Americans and Muslims. That gap has not decreased. The challenge still remains in understanding.
Ambassador Ahmed, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Akbar Ahmed is a professor of Islamic studies at American University. His book is called Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam.
When the Vatican issued new rules this week making it easier to remove sexually abusive priests, the church was silent on the question of reporting those abuses to the police. The new rules also put into the same category of very serious offenses against the church the attempted ordination of women. NPR's Silvia Pagioli has more from Rome.
The new norms double the statute of limitations for disciplinary action against pedophile priests from 10 to 20 years. The changes, the first in nearly a decade, will speed up church procedures in defrocking abusive priests and for the first time codify the possession and distribution of child pornography as a grave crime under church law. The same penalties for sex abuse of minors will also be applied to abuse of the mentally disabled. Ann Barrett Doyle of the U.S.-based bishopaccountability.org says the new norms amount to administrative tinkering of a secretive internal process.
There's been massive evidence of widespread child sexual abuse within the church. And what the Vatican did today was the equivalent of bringing a toy shovel to an avalanche. And you have internal church policies that are secretive. They don't do much to keep children safer.
Contrary to the expectations of many victims groups, the new norms do not include the requirement that bishops report abusive clergy to the police. Barrett Doyle says transparency is essential.
We need the names of abusers and we need the names of supervisors who enabled them. Without the names and without the information, there can be no real accountability. And if the church is just secretly removing priests from ministry and putting them in the secular realm, they are merely transferring the problem from within the church to the society at large.
In an unexpected move, the Vatican document also lists the attempted ordination of a woman as one of the most serious crimes against church law, and that it is to be handled by the same Vatican department that deals with sex abuse. Vatican observers say this inclusion appears to reflect an increasingly conservative trend in the Holy See as it reacts to what it sees as growing hostility in the secular West. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court decision to allow a sex abuse lawsuit in Oregon against the Vatican to proceed, and the recent series of spectacular police raids against the Belgian Catholic Church, suspected of having protected many pedophile priests. John Allen is the Vatican expert at the National Catholic Reporter.
Psychologically, the policy-setting class in Catholicism has gone from seeing itself as a majority in the West to seeing itself as an embattled minority. At best, ignored by, and at worst, persecuted by, the culture-shaping majorities in the West.
Allen says the Catholic Church is increasingly aware that it is no longer the chaplain of the West and is now determined to circle the wagons.
While they would say that reforms are necessary for the Church to respond to the crisis, they would also say that the top concern of the moment has to be protecting the Church's identity so that it is not simply swallowed up or destroyed from within by what they would see as a kind of outright hostile secular climate of opinion.
Allen points to the recent changes in personnel in the Curia, the Vatican bureaucracy, in which Pope Benedict's new appointments are theologians rather than Vatican diplomats. The reshuffle is seen as shoring up traditional doctrine as a key mark of the Church's identity. The Pope also created the Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization, a new department to counter secularism in the West, where, as clerical sex abuse scandals have multiplied, Catholics have been abandoning the Church in the tens of thousands. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.